68, it was not even 10 years before most of those baby boomers married, had kids, and were looking for jobs. My generation found out that the forms we live in are very resistant to change. Once you have a family and a mortgage, you're not freewheeling anymore.
I was raised a family, then I'm glad I'm on my own. 'Cause I was raised a family, then I'm glad I'm on my own. I mean, God bless the child that can learn to live alone. About my cousin, what it was it did him in. Better depend on where it's gay. Rock cut, bootleg, bathtub gin. Like it took a whole lot of liquor just to let him live in his own skin.
On March 12, 1966, I turned 18 years old. The law said I had to go down to Selective Service and register for the draft. This was one time I was happy to be living in a locked ward of a psychiatric hospital. An attendant named Carl was assigned to accompany me to the draft board. Carl and another male nurse agreed to collaborate in a bit of theater. They put on white coats and walked me into the draft board in Town Hall at Central Square in Cambridge. They sat me down on a chair between them and announced to the town clerk, "James here is a mental patient. He's a good kid, but he's fucked up. He's here to register for the draft." I got my deferment on the spot. I was not going to Vietnam. I finished my senior year of high school at the Arlington School at McLean. Once you got your diploma, they wanted you to find a job. I still lived at the hospital, but I was allowed to go out to work. Zach Wiesner was a pal of mine from the Vineyard. He would later be the bass player in our group, The Flying Machine. Zach's friend, Dave Barry, worked at a leather goods workshop where they made shoulder bags and backpacks. I got a job there operating a foot press, cutting hides. I didn't really feel this was my vocation. One Sunday, when the security was lax, Zach drove Dave's truck to McLean, and we sneaked my stuff out and went back to his place in Cambridge. I had used up all my college money at McLean already. I didn't have any more, so I don't think they really cared that I was gone, but I still felt like a fugitive and wanted to leave the area in case they came looking for me. Zach and I decided we would move down to New York City and start a band with Cooch. His group, the King Bees, had split up, and he was open to forming a new group with us. The King Bees drummer, Joel Bishop O'Brien, was available too. Two guitars, bass, and drums. We were fully equipped. Zach and I got a room at the Albert Hotel on University Place between Union Square and Washington Square. John and Michelle Phillips wrote California Dreaming in the Albert, and the Loving Spoonful had rehearsed there. The hotel had recently had a fire, and one floor was destroyed. We got a room on the burned-out floor for cheap. The Flying Machine rehearsed in the basement. I feel I should say something here about Cooch, Danny Korchmar. Cooch has been a constant in my life ever since we were kids on Martha's Vineyard. When I arrived in New York, he was already married and somewhat established as a professional musician. He was willing to support me completely. In our new band, I was the singer and main songwriter. Danny always pushed me forward. The Flying Machine got a gig at a club on McDougal and 3rd Street called the Night Owl Cafe. I had a few songs, Knockin' Round the Zoo, Rainy Day Man, Brighten Your Night with My Day. I wrote Night Owl in honor of our new venue. Heading out into the world to play music was not a career path. It was an abandonment of conventional ambitions. It was like becoming a hobo and riding the rails. No one was offering music business as a college degree. Any hope that my family might have had that I would pull myself together and go to college, study law or medicine, was now abandoned. I was heading into a territory for which there was no map. I was free. The Love and Spoonful had been the resident band at the Night Owl just before we arrived. We dreamed of having success like theirs. By the time I landed in Greenwich Village, a lot of people had left. Stephen Stills and Richie Furay had gone to L.A. to form Buffalo Springfield. The Mamas and the Papas had moved to California, too. Hendrix had gone to London. There might have been a feeling that the best days of the village were in the rearview mirror, but it was still an exciting place to be a teenager, liberated from all expectations. I had four or five records I listened to way too much. The Beatles' Revolver, Fantasia on Greensleeves by Rafe Vaughan Williams, Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain, and Stan Getz's album with The Girl from Ipanema by Antonio Carlos Jobim and Astrid and João Gilberto. Almost 20 years later, I played the first Rock in Rio festival in Brazil. It was a transformative experience for me. 300,000 people knew the words to my songs and sang along. It was an incredible leg up for me at a time in my life when I was struggling. It really made me feel like I had landed back on my feet. There was so much traffic that it took us 10 hours to make it back to the hotel. When I got there, Caetano Veloso and his wife took me to a place called Circo Voador, which means flying circus. It was a building made of pipe scaffolding with sheets of corrugated roofing tin wired to the outside of it. This huge mound of a building somewhere in Rio de Janeiro. Inside, there were people on the floor and also up in the scaffolding, in a kind of a sci-fi type tunnel. There was Chico Buarque. There was Simoni, all celebrating the election of Tancredo Neves after 20 years of the junta. Everyone was on stage. Some had been exiled, some had been imprisoned. Some had been unable to play their music in their home country for half of their careers. That's a precious memory for me, and it connected back to the summer of 1967 in New York when I listened to that music for hours and hours. The Flying Machine's drummer, Joel O'Brien, exposed me to a lot of Latin music. He was deep into Eddie Palmieri and the Fania All-Stars, and a Cuban player named Arsenio Rodriguez. Joel was a true musicologist. He showed me jazz, a lot of Irish music, but primarily Afro-Cuban and salsa, Latin stuff. It had a huge effect on me. Joel also introduced me to heroin. He was a user, and I wanted to see what it was about. Danny tried hard to warn me off it, but I was too curious. Any drug is a shortcut to the mechanism that makes a reward in your brain. We all want to escape ourselves. I keep coming back to the idea that human consciousness is bifurcated. A tiger has teeth and claws. We have analyzing and predicting mechanisms whose original function was looking for trouble. We are always on the defensive. We expect the negative. The best part of us knows we have to transcend that. If we are going to survive as a family, as a tribe, as a nation, as a species, we have to think as a collective. We have to cooperate. We are divided between being and seeing. Religious faith moves us towards a collective consciousness. So does music. It allows us to give our individuated egos the slip. Music is not only a human language, but it's also true to the laws of physics. An octave is double the octave below it and half of the octave above it. Music is not arbitrary. It is empirically real and true. It follows the rules. Music takes us outside the prison of the self, which is an ecstatic thing to have happen. I think intoxication is the same drive. For better or for worse, opiates and psychedelics also move us away from the individual prison, or at least they help us transcend our egos for a while. So, there I was in New York in 1967, playing in a band, having fun, taking heroin. There was a gang of us. Richard Corey was the son of the comedian Professor Irwin Corey. Later on, I took up with Richard's sister, Margaret. Susie Schnurr was a good friend who tripped with us, took speed with us, ran wild. Her parents committed her to a state psychiatric facility. She was the Suzanne in Fire and Rain. The flying machine made a bad deal with a couple of music biz entrepreneurs. They said they wanted to record us, which is just what we wanted to hear. When we got to their office, they presented me with a contract that gave them the publishing on my songs. I was a teenage kid with no lawyer, no manager. The other guys were telling me, James, just sign it. We need to make a record. So I signed it. We never got to make that album. Just a 3-hour session to produce some bad demos. Later on, after I made it big, those two guys released the demos as an album with my name on it. What an embarrassment. And they would have my music publishing on my first 4 albums. Those two operators got paid for my songs, even though they never came through with anything they promised us when we were hungry kids just looking to make a record. The flying machine was falling apart, and I was strung out. I called my father on the phone, and he heard in my voice that I was in bad shape. He said, "How are you doing, son?" I said, "Dad, not so good." He asked me for my address and told me to stay right there. He was coming for me. Ike rented a car in North Carolina and drove through the night to New York to collect me. He saw I was in bad shape, got me into the car, and we were straight back on the road, headed south. On the journey, my dad told me that when he became a physician, his uncle James warned him to never, ever take any opiate. It was poison to the tailors. Try it even once, and you'll be enslaved. Our family of doctors must have had some bad experiences after the Civil War, when there was a morphine epidemic among the veterans. In Carolina, I managed to detox by drinking several bottles of cough syrup a day. I went from drugstore to drugstore so no one would catch on how much codeine I was sucking down. I had messed up my voice singing over a loud rock band, and I needed throat surgery. Dad got that done, too. When I was feeling better, I hatched the idea that it would be good for me to go to London to try to play music over there. I had a small inheritance, enough for the plane ticket. A couple of my friends were living there, including Albie Scott from the Vineyard. Albie was a true free spirit. When I was 16, I had gone on the International Friends trip to Scandinavia, the Soviet Union, Munich, Warsaw, and finally East Berlin. We were on a bus waiting to pass through Checkpoint Charlie, the border to West Berlin, when I looked out the window and saw what looked like the caricature of a hippie. Wild clothes, big boots, long hair tied back in a braid, a wrap-around furry Freak Brothers mutton chop mustache, and I realized it was Albie. I yelled out his name and pounded on the window, got off the bus, and stayed with him for a few days in a squat, leaning up against the free side of the Berlin Wall. My parents were not crazy about my leaving for England, but I assured them it was okay. I got there, scuffled around, stayed with Albie and different friends of friends. I went into a record-yourself booth in Soho and made a demo of several of my songs, including Something in the Way She Moves. I hoped it would help get me some jobs, maybe playing in clubs. Cooch and the Kingbees had done a U.S. tour backing up the British duo Peter and Gordon. Cooch gave me a phone number for Peter Asher and said, "I don't know if it still works, but give him a try." I called Peter and introduced myself as a friend of Danny's. We chatted for a while, and he invited me to come visit him at home the next evening. Peter looked like a pop star, with long red hair and hip Buddy Holly glasses. He was only a few years older than me, but he had already been in and out of international success. I played him my demo, and he liked it. He handed me one of his guitars, and I played him a couple more songs. He was very encouraging. Peter told me that he was no longer singing. He had taken a job as the head talent scout for the Beatles' new label, Apple Records. He suggested I come by the office later in the week and play my songs to whichever Beatle was around that day. This is when my life passed through the looking glass. Peter likes to tell the story that he stepped out in the Apple hallway, shouted, "Is there a Beatle in the house?" and Paul McCartney appeared. There actually might have been a couple more steps between my arriving at Apple and my being introduced to Paul, but the way Peter tells it is how it felt. I walked in off the street, and pretty soon I had a guitar in my hands and was singing and playing for Paul McCartney and George Harrison. They gave Peter their blessing to sign me to Apple and to make an album. It seemed impossible. I don't remember if I told anybody right away. I guess I called Cooch. He thought that was pretty fast work. He was glad he gave me the right phone number. It turned out that I needed to get my father to co-sign the contract, as I was under 21, and they were more serious about that sort of thing in England than they had been in New York. I called Ike long distance and said, "Please, Dad, just sign it. It's the Beatles." Peter and I began recording the James Taylor album in between the Beatles' White Album sessions. They had Trident Studio in Leicester Square in Soho booked solid, so we hung out and watched them work, and when they would leave for the night, we would start. I was watching the Beatles record when I remembered a moment a few years earlier. In high school, I'd been making moves on a girl in her room in Boston. She wasn't letting me get very far. "Would you let me sleep with you if I knew the Beatles?" She said, "You don't know the Beatles." Where was she now? Peter produced my album. Bishop O'Brien from the Flying Machine flew over to play drums, and we found the rest of the musicians through ads in the music papers. It was really heady stuff. I felt like I was in the big leagues. During a break in the recording, I took a 5-day trip down to Formentera, an island in the Spanish Mediterranean. I was riding bikes and drinking cough syrup, and I met a girl named Karen. We took a boat to Ibiza for the day, but we missed the last boat back. We had no money for a hotel, so we sat outside a closed cafe by the sea all night, waiting for the first boat in the morning. I found a piece of paper and wrote these lyrics. Karen, she's a silver sun. You best walk her way and watch it shine. Watch her watch the morning come, a silver tear appearing. Now I'm crying, ain't I? I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. When I got back to London, we worked on Carolina in my mind. McCartney played bass on it. Peter says George Harrison was not there, but I have a distinct memory of George singing on the session too. I wish he were here to ask. I had a car in London, a green English Ford Cortina GT, my heart's delight. One morning at sunrise, I was accelerating up the narrow street behind Harrods in Knightsbridge when a huge, wild man jumped from behind a box lorry parked at the curb and right into my path. There was nothing I could do. I hit him and the brakes at the same time and watched in horror as he skidded sickeningly to a stop in the gutter, dead to the world. My bright future turned to ashes before my eyes. I was high and holding, my pockets full of the drugs I had just scored. And the police were right there. My life just beginning was finished. It took me a moment to hear what the bobby was saying. Thank God you got him, sir. My hapless victim had stolen the cop's helmet and nightstick, and after beating the patrolman with it, had continued down the Brompton Road, singing in Gaelic, breaking shop windows. But I think I've killed him, I said. And a good thing if you have too, sir. Are you all right, sir? I had run to where our poor Irishman lay against the curb, and as they put the cuffs on him and lifted him into the back of a van, he opened one eye, staring right at me. You fucker, he said. My luck's run out. His, but not mine. I had started using heroin again in London. It was inexpensive and readily available. One time John Lennon asked me and my friend Joel to score some hashish for him. We did, but I'm not sure the stuff we delivered was real hash. It might have been messed with. Then John asked to try some of my methadone, and I gave him a dose too big to be taken by a civilian. I'm sure glad I didn't kill John Lennon that day. Years later, in 1980, I would live in a building one block north of the Dakota where John and Yoko lived. In early December, I was coming home on the subway and got off at 72nd Street, my stop. A creepy, sweaty guy recognized me and got in my face. He was talking fast, telling me about himself, that he was working on a project with John Lennon. I had spent 9 months in a psychiatric hospital, and it seemed to me that he was mentally ill. I got away from him as quickly as I could. Turns out he was Mark Chapman. The next night I was sitting in the window of my apartment on Central Park West, talking on the phone to Peter Asher's wife, Betsy, when I heard 5 rapid shots from a .38. I told Betsy, the cops just shot a guy, outside on the street. 20 minutes later, Betsy called me back. She said, "That was not a police shooting. That was John Lennon." 50 years later, I can't get over what the Beatles did for me. Their approval validated my music and introduced me to the world I have lived in ever since. The Beatles opened a door and invited me through. It was a dividing line in my life. When I finished recording the Apple album in 1968, I spent the night drinking with Joel O'Brien. When we were both pretty well oiled, he decided to tell me something that my friends had been keeping secret. Susie Schnur, our friend from New York and the Flying Machine days, had committed suicide by throwing herself in front of the Lexington Avenue subway at the 23rd Street station. Joel and Richard and Margaret Corey had all known and decided to keep it from me until after the album was finished. I was stronger than they thought, but of course it shook me up. Susie was troubled, but so was I. So were a lot of us at that time. She didn't need to be locked up in a state hospital. She needed to know that she was loved. I reacted to the news by starting a song. "Just yesterday morning they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you." I would carry that song with me for the next year or so. Then that song would carry me for the rest of my life. By the time my first album was released by Apple at the end of 1968, I was in bad shape from drug use and general malnutrition. Apple was in trouble, too. Lennon had signed with the Rolling Stones' old business manager, Alan Klein, whom McCartney did not trust at all. George and Ringo threw in with John. Paul was excluded and outvoted. The Beatles were coming apart. My album got good reviews, but did not sell very well. Carolina in My Mind was not a hit, not then anyway. Peter Asher said, "This place is coming apart. Klein doesn't care about any of the acts except the Beatles. Let's you and me get out of here. We'll go to the States, I'll be your manager, and we'll get you a new record deal." Getting out of my Apple contract was not hard. The deal gave me a right to audit the company, and Alan Klein didn't want any of that. McCartney gave me a release so that Apple would not claim an override on my future recordings. The Beatles always treated me right. Back in the USA, Peter went to California to set up a new home, and I checked into Austin Riggs, a hospital in the Berkshires, to try to kick heroin again. Austin Riggs was a psychiatric hospital, so I was officially enrolled as a mental patient, but the purpose was to get off drugs. I wrote a lot of the songs that would appear on Sweet Baby James at Austin Riggs. While I was struggling with my addiction, I added some lines to the song I had begun about Susie Schnur. "Won't you look down on me, Jesus? You got to help me to make a stand. You just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand, and I won't make it any other way." Austin Riggs Hospital is very close to where I live now. Life circles around. While I had been in England, my brother Alex and his wife Brent had a baby, the first Taylor of the next generation. They named him after me, little baby James. When I got out of Austin Riggs, I made a trip down south to meet my namesake. I wrote Sweet Baby James on the way. That song is a snapshot of that moment in my family's life, the arrival of a new baby, the turnpike from Stockbridge to Boston. There's a song that they sing of their home in the sky. Maybe you can believe it if it helps you to sleep. Alex and Kate and Livingston would join the new family business. A generation later, so would my older children, Ben and Sally. It does not escape me that in my attempt to escape my family, I ended up becoming the new patriarch. The Taylors had always gone to college and become doctors and lawyers. Now we went to psychiatric hospitals and became musicians. Liv, Kate, Hugh, and I, we all made it. Alex was the casualty, the oldest brother, the rebel, the first one through the door. Alex would die of alcoholism in 1993, on my birthday, at the age of 46. I processed his death the way I do. I made it into a song. So the sun shines on this funeral, just the same as on a birth. The way it shines on everything that happens here on earth. It rolls across the western sky, back into the sea. Spends the day's last rays upon this fucked up family. So long, old pal. The last time I saw Alice, she was leaving Santa Fe with a bunch of round-eyed Buddhists in a killer Chevrolet. Said they turned around to Texas. Yeah, she burned them down back home. Now she's wild with expectation on the edge of the unknown. Singing, oh, it's enough to be on your way. It's enough to cover ground. It's enough to be moving on. Home, build it behind your eyes. Cabin it in your heart. Safe among your own. In that song, my brother Alex becomes a woman named Alice. Songs can be personal, autobiographic, even confessional, but they also have to rhyme and scan and fit into 16 or so even lines. Because of those requirements, songs take left turns when you are writing them. The architecture of the composition will introduce lines and phrases that send you down new paths. You hope it makes for a better song, even if it moves the story a step or two away from what really happened. But that's the way it's supposed to be. The initial motivation for writing a song may be some personal experience, but if it doesn't speak to other people, if it doesn't offer solace or entertainment or identification or make you want to dance or hum along, it's going to fail as a song. The success of an artist is not measured by how much he makes himself feel. His success is how much he makes other people feel. In the spring of 1969, Peter Asher was working to get me a new record deal. I was playing folk clubs to make some money. On July 20th, I played a 15-minute set at the Newport Folk Festival on a bill with Joni Mitchell, Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, Van Morrison, Arlo Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Muddy Waters, and Doug Kershaw. That's around when Joni Mitchell and I first met, although we would not become romantically involved right away. Love songs are the main currency of popular music. Joni said, "Songs are like tattoos. They follow you forever, even when the relationship is long over." When I sing "You Can Close Your Eyes" with my wife Kim today, it's as much our song as it is anyone else's, as it is everyone else's. Falling in love with Kim put my life back on the path I might have wandered off forever. Kim brought me back to my roots in Massachusetts, back to going to Red Sox games, and even back to playing the cello.
Take you by your hand, somewhere on the sand, oh, Caroline, I love you, though I'm late to say so. Hesitate to tell you what will be your answer some December morning, standing on the stairway, Caroline, I see you.
Kim also gave me a second chance at having a family, now that I was old enough and clear-headed enough to take it on. With Kim, I was able to break the patterns I had inherited from my father. I was able to become my own man. The 1969 Newport Folk Festival would turn out to be my last performance for 7 months. When I got back to the vineyard, I crashed a motorcycle and broke both my hands. I know it didn't make it any easier for Peter to find a record deal for me. I couldn't play the guitar. Peter put up with a lot. It was hard for me not to be able to pick up my instrument. When the casts came off my hands, it felt like the songs came pouring out. Peter had made a deal for me with Warner Brothers Records. We had a short window to record in L.A. and a very tight budget. There was never any question that Cooch would be part of the band, and he brought in a piano player I hit it off with right away. Her name was Carol King. Meeting Carol was like meeting a long-lost friend. She and I felt the same way about music, about making records, about writing songs. She had a glorious history as a pop composer. With her husband, Jerry Goffin, she had written pop standards that inspired the Beatles and everyone else. Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? Natural Woman, Crying in the Rain, Chains, Was Not Born to Follow, Up on the Roof. Carol and Jerry were divorced, and she had moved from New York to California to start over. Having her in my band was a blessing. She would become a lifelong friend. When Carol heard me sing, "I've Seen Lonely Times When I Could Not Find a Friend," she wrote an answer song, "You've Got a Friend." L.A. at that time was home to Cooch and Peter and Carol, as well as Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joni Mitchell, and other fellow travelers who would share the road ahead with me. Joni and I would take up together for a while. We would play and sing on each other's albums, and we would find our way into some of each other's songs. Our romance did not last that long, but our friendship has sustained for almost 50 years. Christmas of 1969 was coming, and I was one song short of completing my first album and collecting the completion payment from Warner Brothers Records, $20,000. I really needed that dough. Working against the clock, we cobbled together bits and pieces of several of my unfinished songs and called it Sweet for 20G. The album we named Sweet Baby James was finished. In early 1970, a billboard with my face on it went up on the Sunset Strip. Peter got me booked on the Dick Cavett Show on ABC. An offer came in for me to star in a movie. My whole life, I had been known as Ike Taylor's son. It was a hard part for me to play. our relationship was about to change. He would soon be identified as James Taylor's father. I felt like I had traveled a very long way, North Carolina and Martha's Vineyard, McLean Psychiatric Hospital and Greenwich Village, recording with the Beatles in London, and kicking heroin at Austin Riggs. I was 21 years old.
Just yesterday morning, they didn't know you were gone. Suzanne Clancy made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down the song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days, but they never end. I've seen lonely times and could not find a friend. But I always thought I'd see you again. Took down on me, Jesus. You gotta help me to make a stand. You just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days, I thought they'd never end. I've seen lonely times and I could not find a friend. But I always thought I'd see. To an easy time, my back turned towards the sun. Lord knows a cold wind blows like to turn your head around. There's hours of time on telephone lines just talking about things that come. Sweet dreams and flying machines in pieces on the ground. Sunny days, thought they never end. I've seen lonely times and I could not find a friend. But I always thought I'd see you somehow one more time again. Thought I'd see you one more time.
This has been an Audible Originals production of Breakshot, My First 21 Years, written and performed by James Taylor. Produced by Bill Flanagan. Audio produced, mixed, and edited by Dave O'Donnell. Audio assistant, Tyler Hartman. Original music composed and performed by James Taylor. Original music produced by Dave O'Donnell. Guitar technician, Jonathan Prince. Studio director for The Barn and assistant to James Taylor, Ellen Cussman. James Taylor thanks Sam Feldman, Michael Gorfain, Jane Muckle, Margie Chesky, and everyone at Fantasy Records. For Audible, executive producer Preston Copley. Additional audio production by Jeff Dudzik. Executive in charge, content acquisition and development, Elizabeth Scholar. Production counsel, John Kurland. Content rights and clearances, Michelle Postel. Audible Originals editor-in-chief, Dave Blum. Vice president of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Special thanks to Britt McCombs, Jenna Hudson, Allison Weber, Josh Pelzik, Doug Pollison, Stephen Marzolf, Stacy Cloutier, Josh Fisher, Vanessa Harris, Caitlin Confort, Chelsea Adams, Lisa Hintelman, and Elliot Wilson. Copyright 2020 by James V. Taylor. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.